You have tuned in to an encore presentation of Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM. Thanks so much for listening. A whole bunch of issues, a letter from the city of Bellingham to our federal delegation, some political stuff, some slaps on the wrist, a tax day bus, but let's start with an update about the hunger strike in Tacoma at the Tacoma Northwest Detention Center. This is day three. It started on Monday. And the strike is similar to a strike that happened at the detention center in 2014. And according to their press release, they're saying that this is from the NWDC resistance, that the Tacoma facility is it's connected with the multinational private prison corporation, the GEO Group. There's a lot of issues that they are asking for: improving medical attention, improving hygiene, more recreation, having schoolwork programs available, increasing the pay. The press release says that people get a dollar an hour, but sometimes don't get that at all. And one of the most important things is helping to speed up the legal process for detainees.
And I wish them all the best. It's really scandalous how we treat people when they're incarcerated in this country. And the conditions, as we've seen over the last few years, in these private-run facilities are that much worse. And I hope that they are able to get something. I can't say I have a lot of faith in the ICE leadership or the corporate leadership to do what's right, but...
And let's be clear that this is not for criminals. This is not incarceration so much as detention. Like, these are people who are immigrants that are being supposedly held before they are taken somewhere else. But from the claims of this press release, it sounds like they're being treated exactly like prisoners.
Yeah, I applaud them for standing up for their rights, because people continue to have rights in our society, even if they are in the country illegally. They still have rights in our society. I mean, that's been a standard of the courts for more than a century. You know, this is a perfect storm brewing, because one of the great fears of, like, local law enforcement was that people would be afraid to call 911 in the case of emergency to report crimes, because they don't want people showing up and then dragging members of the family away under whatever pretense. You've got people that work in agriculture concerned, because crackdowns mean that there may not be migrant farm labor available for them when it's necessary. And this is all driven by some political promises that were kind of suspect in the first place. It's very tragic to see our society descending into this sort of spiral.
Well, Dave said that he wished them all the best, and we don't know if it's going to be effective. But one thing, I spoke with Maru Mora Villalpando this afternoon, and she did talk about the 2014 hunger strike being effective. So that's one thing. And she also said they had originally talked about doing a 3-day hunger strike, but more and more people have joined, and now there's 700 people on the inside who are on strike. And but one of the interesting things this time is ICE is refusing to call it a hunger strike. They're claiming that detainees can get food in commissary, and so they're sort of resisting that whole even being willing to hear the issues.
Well, that's absurd, because, I mean, a hunger strike is not related to your ability to get food. It's your voluntary refusal of food in order to raise political awareness and raise public awareness of particular issues. So the idea that, well, they could go eat an apple, so they're not really striking, is ridiculous.
And that's exactly what Villalpando said. She said this shows how low ICE would be to undermine the sacrifice that people are taking, and that it sort of shows ICE's true colors. I mean, certainly we can make comparisons to other resistance movements, but to even deny the suffering that somebody's taking on because they're taking a stand and because they're being treated so horribly and there's no other way on the inside that you can really draw attention to these issues. I agree with you. It's pretty horrific.
And I would, you know, to explain my skepticism a little bit, the strike in 2014 was successful. And I don't think it was because it was more people and this one might grow. I think it was because at the time we had a federal administration that could be embarrassed about the conditions under which people were being held. And many of these people are waiting to see judges. They are not, you know, this isn't just hold them before they're deported. This is also people who are waiting to have hearings. And
have not been found to be guilty or even whether or not they are a type of immigrant that is not documented or
whether they're being improperly detained.
Improperly detained, absolutely. Or whether or not ICE even picked the right person.
Correct.
So, Dave, I think you make an excellent point, which leads us to talking about more federal issues. But I do want to say, if you're interested in knowing more following this story, you can go to NWD, that's Northwest Detention Center, NWTCresistance.org. You can also look up NWDC Resistance on Facebook. We hope to talk more with Maru and some people from that group next week. But like you said, you brought up an excellent point about the current administration and their, as you said, an inability to be embarrassed. And you are not the only person who is frustrated with the federal government this week. As a matter of fact, our own city council is frustrated with the government this week. This is something that Jean Knudsen said this weekend at the Women's Legislative Brunch.
Occupant of the Oval Office's budget. And I got to tell you, folks, we're going to have a letter on our agenda on Monday to send to all of our delegation, Democrat and Republican, to oppose this piece of garbage and have it thrown in. From the city of Bellingham perspective, it's anywhere of a cut from $3 to $20 million. Our HUD funding, which we get $1.5 million, $2 million every year. Our transportation, it's devastating. I just hope there's enough sense in Congress that they will reject this thing.
So that was Councilman Jean Knudsen speaking at the Women's Legislative Brunch this weekend about a letter that actually Mayor Linville and Michael Lilquist, the president of the council, signed. And they brought it before city council this Monday, and it was passed unanimously. They are talking particularly about the housing and urban development funding that Bellingham gets, nearly $1.1 million.
Well, I always love it when Gene storms because he's a very passionate person. He's a very caring person. And one of the interesting things about him is that he is probably, at this moment in time, he's not only served longest on the council, he might be the most conservative person on the council. And so when he expresses outrage, I think he's expressing a very heartfelt, genuine concern. And we've talked about these kinds of things on the show before, and we'll talk about them again. But when you have federal directives that you're required to do under the law, and then there is the withholding of money from the federal government or a budget cut, then it just becomes cruel because the city has certain obligations they need to make under the housing or urban development rules, and they do it. And that HUD money is very valuable in addressing issues of housing affordability and homelessness, and the city has very passionately been at work on those issues. And then to have that threatened to be withdrawn, it drew an outrage letter from Bellingham City Council.
And it impacts our seniors as well, as one of the things that this letter points out. And you can find the letter on the City of Bellingham website, on the COB website, for all of the information about it. But the letter that they crafted talks about low income, mostly senior households being affected, about 900 distinct addresses from 1977, and the depth of the impact that not having this funding and as proposed in the federal budget will have.
And I'm very happy to see them engaging in this way. And it's very easy to be against a certain thing if you don't understand what it's for and what good it does. And I think that this is a, you know, it's firm, but it feels like an olive branch, like, let us help you understand why this is important and worth preserving. And I really hope that they do a cute little video like they did when they were going for Google Fiber.
I hope that wasn't the city council that did that video, was it?
It was adorable, it was a city something.
Well, let's also hope this letter is more effective than that cute Google Fiber video.
Well, you know, and I think the thing that listeners need to understand is that almost every federal dollar that comes is a matching dollar. It's part of it. So this, what the city is doing is it's investing an equivalent amount of money in order to receive some analogous amount of money from federal government. And that helps local dollars stretch farther. And so one of the things that's happened, and not just in this administration, but over a long period of time, is federal dollars have been withdrawn, and that puts more and more pressure on the state. And then the state withdraws because it is having its budget. And so it all comes down to this local level, and there's not enough local dollars to go around. So anytime those matching dollars are threatened, it's very frightening for city leaders, because programs that are underway and proving success are threatened.
Well, it's interesting that you explain it that way, because we were talking about our most conservative council person, Jean Knudsen, being riled up. And I think you make an excellent point. It's not, as some conservatives might think, it's not Bellingham asking for a handout. It's Bellingham depending on a partnership.
Yes.
And Bellingham is putting in this effort and trying to help people and make Bellingham great, one might say. And there has been this ongoing, there's been an understanding of an ongoing agreement that the federal government matches the efforts, the good faith efforts of a municipality.
Right. And just imagine if you are facing a problem that in one sense or another you perceive as getting worse, like housing affordability, like homelessness, it's getting worse on its own without the federal government coming in and threatening to strip away what cash you had coming in on that program. It just accelerates the problem that and it's a problem for our city, and it's a problem for our state, but it accelerates those problems already underway.
Well, it's interesting. I find it a little ironic that when we talked about the Sanctuary City movement and the outcome of the Sanctuary City movement, it seemed that the city of Bellingham was more reserved than, say, the city of Seattle in their decision to not actually use the term sanctuary and not to take some steps. And it seemed that maybe one of the reasons the city of Bellingham was being more reserved was to avoid not getting federal funding or avoid being penalized. And here it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, and I think that's the way I would characterize it. It doesn't make any difference, because I think there was concern from the city of Bellingham about being provocative and inviting the federal government to do bad things. And here the federal government's going to do them anyway. And the corollary is in California, which has been very blunt and blatant about its resistance to federal directives. And they asked for a bunch of disaster relief, and they got it. So there seems to be no correlation between a community stepping up and saying that they have values and what the federal government's response is going to be to that.
This may not be the only time, even this week, that the federal government has been accused of a lack of rhyme and reason. So that's interesting. The other thing that I like, or I found particularly powerful and inspiring about this, is that it has seemed for some of us that want Bellingham to take more of a stand, that Bellingham doesn't tend to stand up to the federal government. Bellingham doesn't tend to occupy itself with issues about the federal government. And this letter, which I don't know if I clarified before, is going to our federal delegation. So it's going to Del Benny, Rick Larson, Maria Cantwell, Senator Patty Murray, and also President Trump.
Right.
So that, to me, and it was unanimously voted. It was a great partnership with the mayor and the council. And I find that really encouraging.
Yes. And as far as the congressional delegation goes, I mean, that is what they're for. I mean, that's one part of what they're for, but therefore they're there to take a message from the cities and governments of Washington and the people of Washington, and to take those things back and be champions for those things in Washington, D.C. And so we're calling, I mean, we're paying these people money, our senators and our congressional representatives, and now we're asking them to stand up and be brave and strong for the people of Washington.
And gosh knows, Bellingham citizenry is not reticent in terms of asking things of our representatives,
right.
But it's nice to see our city council and our mayor doing it, and
right.
And I think that's great. One thing I did want to throw in, because we are talking about this letter going to Senator Murray, and she was actually in town yesterday.
Yeah, she was in town yesterday, and I had a rare opportunity to see her work. She was gathering information. It was an information gathering mission to Planned Parenthood in Bellingham, because that's going to be a major fight in Congress. In fact, there probably will be a government shutdown over the issue of the defunding of Planned Parenthood. It's become an intractable issue with Congress, but she was there to basically to tour the facility and to hear the stories of people who have received women's health services from Planned Parenthood. And I don't think it's widely understood, but the hospitals and the clinics, they very, very much support Planned Parenthood's women's health services, because that takes the load off them. And so if Planned Parenthood is defunded, it simply puts more pressure on the hospitals and whatnot to provide those services that women can't get any other place or any other way.
And then interesting parallel in terms of us losing money and support for funding, the same parallel exists where sometimes agencies like Planned Parenthood are typified as getting some sort of money bag for abortions, that it's really a reimbursement for medical services, and it's not at full cost.
Right. And the federal government does not fund abortions anyway, period. The whole argument is so absurd. It is it's a wedge issue that the Republican Party gets to use on against their in order to do fundraising and to get people riled up. But you know, really, what's at stake is, I mean, it's only what is it? It's like 3% of Planned Parenthood's business is abortions, period, and so the other 97% is providing sexual health services and women's health services to the community. I mean, it's really. It's terrible and tragic that this thing gets wrapped up in some kind of national debate over right to life when that is not even really what's going on at issue. And I guess what I would say, you know, with the time I have left, is it was interesting to see Senator Murray and her process, because, you know, senators, when they kind of come through a room, they usually, they're the center of attention. They are the ones that are giving the speeches. They're the ones that the press are focused on. But her visit to Bellingham was just to very sit very quietly and hear these people's stories and get their information, because she's going to be the point person in Washington, D.C., fighting this fight.
And there are some things about Senator Murray that have irked me. There are things that I will just say have irked Dave. I mean, there's some issues that in terms of internet security and things that she's come down on sides I don't agree with. But, Tim, I think you hit the heart of it. And I know we have a little love fest every once in a while for people. Last week was Chris Litton. But let me just say about Senator Murray, the whole mom in tennis shoes thing is not just a stereotype. She has really somehow maintained this down-to-earthness about her that is so refreshing, and we're so glad she's there. So we talked about that. We started off talking about Gene Knudsen. He was speaking at the Women's Legislative Brunch, and Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner was there she's the executive director of Moms Rising, and some of our other county executives spoke, county council members and city council members. And so we had Gene Knudsen speak and Red Brown, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I really was pretty impressed by Councilwoman April Barker and what she had to say about homelessness.
How we're dealing with homelessness and housing. And we're really struggling in Bellingham. We're moving into being a larger city. I think the implicit bias in all of us that still wants that single family detached home, but doesn't really want to take the time to understand where we're oppressing others in that dream. And that's crucial for Bellingham right now. We have neighborhoods where 80% of the land is for those single detached family homes, and it's the least amount of people living on that land. We have a very important thing to talk about in Bellingham. It's infill, it's density, it's that moral, social, and environmental justice piece. But we come into rooms and we do this, and then we leave, and when it starts to impact us on where we live and how we live our lives, we stop. So my biggest quest for all of us here is the homelessness is very important, but it's simply a system. It's a symptom. That's all it is. So we can't have any of these discussions about women, homelessness, equality. They all have to have housing at the key of them. And Bellingham is critical that we have that conversation. We have completely segregated ourselves as a community. We are 80% white, and we are likely to stay that way if you look at all the projections, because we don't have the middle housing, and we're not supporting people in housing. We're not integrating ourselves socially, which therefore we're not integrating ourselves racially. Yep. And we're putting a lot more pressure on our young mothers to try to make it through. So I will ask that you stay engaged in the housing conversation. I will ask that when you go home today, you just take a look at your street. Maybe you're living in one of those multifamily units. Maybe you should look up and down your street and wonder, who gets to live next door to me? Who gets to go to this public school that our tax dollars are funding? Whose children get to go here? And how could we make Bellingham different? The entire West Coast and most of the country is dealing with this affordable housing problem, and we could be iconic. We could be the place where people come and go, wow, they actually got it. They got that their built environment is completely built out of that classism, racism, sexism scheme. And then they made a big change, which will really take time for us to listen to each other, to have to wonder, like, what are my dreams and my thoughts, and then do they match with how I think we should be moving forward as a community? So I really ask that you stay engaged with those conversations over the next year. It's going to be really crucial for Bellingham and the decisions that we make.
And that was Councilwoman April Barker. She spoke this weekend at the Women's Legislative Brunch and talking about, I thought, very, very effectively and powerfully about homelessness and density. And some of the other people who spoke talking about what was ahead legislatively for city and county. Councilwoman Vargas encouraged women to run for local positions. Jean Knudsen, who you heard earlier, also talked about the jail. And I was really happy to hear him talking about working on alternatives to the jail. He made a very strong stand for mental health and what do we need to do to keep people out of jail, which I think we maybe know where that influence is coming from.
Yeah, and I think that the success of Bellingham's movements towards finding jail alternatives, I mean, it's been so amazing and encouraging that I can't imagine any elected person in Bellingham not being thrilled with that. That, you know, you always want a success story to report out to the public. That's a huge success story about Bellingham's reduction, amazing reduction in sending people to jail and putting them into alternatives. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And so they talked about that, and you know, ADUs came up, and I want to say I was at the Leonard Street's neighborhood meeting last night, and city planner Chris Cook talked a lot about ADUs. He explained how the city is going to go through a whole process with the planning commission and there's going to be a lot of back and forth about it. But I just feel like we're on this precipice of ADUs, and ADUs are attached assisted dwelling units. Is it assisted?
It's yeah, right. They can be either attached or unattached.
Attached or unattached. And what I thought was interesting was Chris Cook, the city planner, talked about the power of the neighborhoods, but that it's kind of in this delayed waiting period because there's the planning and the task force, and like there's going to be a lot of back and forth, but that the neighborhoods are going to weigh in. And one of the reasons I want to bring this up is the Leonard Streets talked a lot about some of their mixed zoning and what might be taking place in terms of density. And what also came up was Happy Valley. And in case you don't know, Happy Valley got a grant to work on alternatives, and they are having something called a YIMBY, which means yes in my backyard. And Tim, do you know a little bit more about their what they're doing?
Not that specifically. I mean, you know, the interesting thing about that clip that we played was all those issues, and they're all kind of entangled together. I mean, when you talk about homelessness and you talk about incarceration rates for homelessness and you talk about housing instability, and you talk about ADUs as a methodology to try to address some of those issues, but those create other problems of their own because people move into a neighborhood and they expect a certain character, and these accessory dwelling units that are popping up are changing the character. So really, I think that what's going on here is, in general, in a large term, is a failure on the part of the city of Bellingham to address some of these issues maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and they're all kind of coming into collision right now.
When pretty much nobody, except for maybe Councilman Knudsen, was actually on the council. But it's definitely coming up. And then the Leonard Streets Neighborhood Association did talk a lot about the Roeder proposed homeless shelter, and some of the same questions came up as in the port meeting about is it going to displace people? And it's going to be interesting to pay attention to. But I just feel like here we are on the verge in 2017 of all of these issues coming up.
And I think April she's a wonderful spokesperson for all of these issues, because I think she gets it in pretty deep ways about income inequality and about gender inequality and racial inequality and how city planning policy needs to address these things. And you need to address them now, because you're trying to plan 20 years in the future. And what's Bellingham going to look like in 20 years? Well, I hope that there's more women in power in Bellingham in 20 years. I hope that there are more people of color living in Bellingham in 20 years. I hope it's a more inclusive society. And I hope that it's not a gated community, because nobody can afford to live here.
Absolutely. And Councilwoman Barker did speak to some of those issues. And yeah, it seems like she really gets it, and it seems like she really cares, and not in any kind of token way. One of the things that she mentioned was that the legislative brunch was on a Saturday and how difficult that was for women with young children, and pointed out that she's the only person who has young children on the council. And
right.
And so that she's representing that. But where was that dynamic in this brunch? And also, I will point out that Councilman Lilliquist did talk about diversity in professionals as well. So I think that came up a couple of times.
And I just wanted to add to what you were saying, Tim. These are the sort of issues that are difficult and expensive. And this right now is as easy and cheap as they're going to be for the foreseeable future, barring something horrible happening. You know, this
tell me what you mean. What's easy and cheap?
I mean, it's addressing our housing issues, addressing our homelessness problem. Those are issues that are going to get more expensive as time
goes
on.
They're never
going
to get any less expensive.
Right. The sooner we take care of them, the better off we are going to be. And I'm frankly kind of happy to see all of these things kind of converging at the same time, because it shows how interconnected they are. It shows how relevant and important all of it is. And it actually makes me feel somewhat hopeful about it.
Well, yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think that the other component of it is hopefully so many of us feeling frustrated or disempowered in terms of what's happening nationally, or for me, what's happening internationally. We don't talk on this show about that kind of thing, but what's happening in Chechnya with gay men being maybe put into camps, and what's happening in Syria, that one of the things that we can do is work to improve our city. And our city is not on the low end of places to be, and our problems are not the most critical on the planet. But there are people suffering. There are people of color who do not get paid as much as white people. There are people who cannot get a job. There are people who have no place to live, and there are people who have mental health issues. And if we can work with our government, our municipal and county governments, I think that's great. By the way, you're listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris, and I'm here with Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. You are listening to KMRE Bellingham, 102.3 FM and KMRE.org. So, for the second half of the hour, let's take a look at what's going on in the state. I think that's the one area that we haven't talked about so far. Dave, as per usual, you're going to let us know what's happening in the legislature and what has currently passed.
Well, we're only like less than 2 weeks now from the theoretical end of the session. Things are happening at kind of a furious pace right now. Only a few things have been signed by the governor so far, but I want to talk about a couple of the things that are waiting for his signature that were particularly interesting. There's a bill that passed last week, Senate Bill 5472, that puts new requirements for ballot drop boxes. So it's one per city, town, census area with a post office, and one per 15,000 county residents.
What is it now? Or is there even a requirement?
There was a requirement. It was less than that. But that's very good. Just today, that got a companion bill, Senate Bill 5336, that makes damaging a ballot box a crime. It's malicious mischief. If you steal a ballot, that's a Class C felony. I was kind of surprised that those weren't explicitly crimes before.
Hooray for democracy.
And we had vandalism of our ballot boxes a couple years ago, didn't we?
And House Bill 1153, which was really heavily pushed by Attorney General Ferguson, which creates a new crime, and that is theft from a vulnerable adult. So previously, if you ripped off a senior or somebody who was in the vulnerable adult category, it was theft, and the victim status was an aggravating factor in sentencing. Now it is a specific crime, and that, according to the Attorney General, is going to make those much easier to prosecute.
I can't imagine there was much pushback on that one from either side of the aisle in Olympia.
No. There's a Senate Bill 5826, which empowers state universities, community colleges, and others to create specific tuition waivers for veterans, or in the case of the death or disability of a veteran, their spouse and children. Also, kind of a love fest. There's a one that I'm a little mixed on, Senate Bill 5200. So right now, if you want to go to Washington State parks and recreation areas, you buy a Discover Pass to be able to park there. And they're $30. It's not a lot. But you can get one for free if you volunteer, if you put in 24 hours of volunteer service. This bill, Senate Bill 5200, lets married couples pool their volunteer hours. So if they combined come up to 24, they can turn that in for a free Discover Pass, which I'm a little mixed on. I mean, okay, it's only $30, but we could have made it like 35 hours or something like that.
Right. Well, I have a problem with the Discover Pass, period, because these are our lands, and that's a tax on our use of using those lands. And, you know, $30 doesn't seem like a lot for some people, but for some other people,
it is.
It's a lot of money.
And you can't, like, apply for some sort of exemption or something.
I understand the logic of that one because, you know, couples generally enjoy the wilderness as a couple. And they're in a team, but it just seems like a little push for a few more community hours of service would be a good thing. I think you're right about that.
You know, and if you're interested, coming up at the end of April, there's work parties happening up on Oyster Dome. They happen all over the state, all through the spring and summer. It's trail clearing. It's not fun, but get yourself a Discover Pass.
Before you move off that topic, and there's other things you want to, where are we at with, and maybe this is the wrong place to talk about this, but where are we at with Galbraith Mountain and funding for that? I mean, for Oyster Dome. Blanchard.
Oh, I do know Blanchard. That Representative Morris released a statement saying that the House budget has the money in it, and they have it in appropriations. But the Senate budget does not. So it's sort of a half victory, and we'll see what happens when the budget's resolved. But yay, House.
Yeah.
Because that's. And do you want to just give a little background again?
Well, this is just. This is just one of these really frustrating things where I don't think there's a lot of opposition anywhere to have this $7.7 million, which is really a drop in the bucket in the state budget, to have this $7.7 million made available. To, you know, keep a section, the most beautiful section of Blanchard Mountain in, and the Oyster Dome intact. So, if this would be like a tragedy if this can't be done, because I really don't think there's any resistance to it at all in Olympia.
And if it's not done, there's going to be deforestation going on.
And one of the most beloved things in Whatcom and Skagit County is going to be lost because you couldn't come to a resolution on a problem for which there's no opposition. It's very frustrating to watch that happen.
Well, I don't think there's anyone who's specifically opposed to this. I think that there are people who are like, oh, you want that? We're not going to do that. You know, I don't think that there's...
Politicking? How strange.
I know, it's crazy. But I completely agree. And especially as we're talking about it, and opening something like that up for development is such a bad idea in that area because of the general landslide risk.
Yes.
And those aren't slopes you want to disrupt unless you absolutely have to.
Right.
And that it impacts water issues and a whole bunch more. Well, thank you for letting us trail you, but I think you have some more to report.
Just a couple of things. I wanted to follow up on last week. I talked about the Sound Transit 3 fight that's going on. The House has passed out of committee a bill that would change the way car tabs are calculated. Specifically for Sound Transit 3, and this is again Pierce, King, and Snohomish County. When the bill was written for Phase 3 of Sound Transit in the legislature, they specifically set it to use the old car tab valuation from the 90s, not the new updated version. And the old version depreciates cars at a much slower rate, so you wind up paying more than your car's actual resale value, or a percentage based on more than your car's actual resale value. And so the House has moved forward a bill that would change that to the more updated, closer to actual value valuations. And some people are freaking out a little bit. There's been a lot of, oh my God, they're defunding Sound Transit, but there's not hard numbers on what exactly that's going to look like, and it's projected over 10 years, so it's difficult to calculate until the budget office gets back, but something to be aware of. And last thing I wanted to talk about made me very happy was Senate Bill 5813, and this is something that folks have been working on for a while. It specifically addresses human trafficking, and it removes "I didn't know their age" or "they told me they were older" as acceptable defenses in trafficking cases, and ups the penalty for child pornography-related crimes. So, again, not a lot of resistance, but it's taken years to get that through.
And that's on the way to the governor's desk, that one?
Yes.
That's great. I can't remember if last week we talked about Senator Ranker, our own Senator Ranker's early childhood education bill that is actually about early outdoor education and really looking, speaking of Blanchard Mountain, but really looking at the ways and encouraging our educational institutions to work on getting students outside more, which, I mean, that's a whole huge issue, but it, I think, is crucial to development and getting people connected with the environment, but also for the health of, I'm not a doctor, but I do not believe that sitting, as especially as a child, for hours and hours is a healthy thing.
No, in fact, years ago, I bumped into some research that said that, if you take children with attention deficit disorders and who act out, and you take them out into the natural world, they calm right down. And it's a very interesting thing. I mean, we're evolutionarily, biologically attuned to being in the natural world, and it's a good thing to get out into it. So I think that those kinds of initiatives, are welcomed, I think, and appreciative, and giving people a love of the environment and the natural world. I mean, I don't see how it can go bad.
And I absolutely agree. And I just want to add, One of my fears as I get older and I start to notice all the ways the world is wrong is that so many kids these days are indoor kids. It's strange in, the areas I'm at to see kids playing outside or just out exploring or things. And I have concerns about what that's going to do to them as they grow up. How are they going to be comfortable being outside? Are they going to know how to be safe and how to be in the world? And I'm excited to see Senator Ranker pushing things in that direction.
You're just a couple of years away from saying kids these days in a much more curmudgeonly tone. But absolutely. And there have been studies, too, about how, I don't know how far you ranged from your homes when you were kids, but that the area that a young person actually ranges around, and some of that's safety issues,
yes.
Some of that's technology.
Yeah, and I would say that those concerns they're not trivial concerns. They're well-founded, but when I was a kid, which was longer ago than I like to admit, but the folks booted you out, on Saturday, and you were going to be outside a lot. My friends and I ranged far and wide, probably a lot farther and wider than was safe. And so I certainly don't chide parents for wanting to keep their kids close by, but it does have an effect. It means that they're more home-centered. And I think part of, childhood development is to risk a little bit, to push an envelope a little bit, to move outward, to explore, and that's part of the whole process of maturation.
I have to just clarify, I believe that nobody at this table is a parent. Is that correct? And because of that, it's very easy for three non-parental people to opine about what parents should do with their kids, and I do it all the time.
And it's fun, too.
And it's fun, and I absolutely know the right way to raise a child. But it is an excellent opportunity for me to say that if you have an issue, if you're a parent, and you want to speak to childhood issues or educational issues, or something similar that's going on in our state or in our communities, that you are welcome to reach out to us. See how I did that? At Facebook, we're at Cascadia News Now, and you can also hear our archives at CascadiaNewsNow.com. So we would love to hear from you and get some different perspectives about that. When Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner, who is the executive director of Moms Rising, and she spoke this weekend in Bellingham, she was also one of the headliners at the Women's March or the Women's March in D.C., and she has recently been talking about multilingual early childhood education, which, again, it could be nothing but a good thing. And I would love to have somebody who knows more than I do about this subject. Before we move on, Dave, you haven't said anything about the budget. Is it just, a big bad hairball of nastiness? Or
it's in the process, and there's a lot of heat, but not a lot of light.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm misreading this, but I actually thought it would be a more bitter fight than it seems to have been. I mean, both houses have produced budgets. They're not that far away from one another. Maybe I'm just being too optimistic to think that they might be able to resolve these things.
There's been a lot of snark. I will say, if you follow a lot of state legislators on Twitter, they've been a little punchy lately. But you're right, there hasn't been a lot of vitriolic, personal attacks, the sort of things that we've seen in budget cycles prior.
Yeah.
So
And they don't seem like they're light years apart. No. They're not that far apart.
Could it possibly be that the federal administration is making people who are on each side less willing to or less likely to be targets or less willing to be targets on the state level?
I think, you know, interestingly, I would say that what's happened is the collapse of what they used to call the majority coalition caucus.
Nice.
And that was this these two Democrats that decided that they would caucus with the Republicans. That has collapsed. And therefore, you can't say that this is a bipartisan thing because you passed your budget over the top of all the Democrats except two, and that this makes it bipartisan. The fig leaf has been torn off of that. And so I think these people have to negotiate like adults.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have a whole lot more going on about legislative stuff. Oh, I do want to say one thing. Dave talked about last week, internet privacy, and Senator Ranker standing up, as seems to be the theme of this week's show, standing up to the federal government by introducing that bill. There was a hearing about that bill today. I don't know any of the details, but Kevin Ranker spoke to Representative Morris, is handling the hearing excellently as a chair, and also said that if any of these big phone companies that are willing to take on themselves not releasing information without permission, that he would switch his phone service immediately, and so would I.
And, you know, Senator Ranker, just quickly, he was smart on this because he reached out to the Republicans and he got some Republican support for this because I think internet privacy is something that cuts across the whole spectrum of our modern life.
Yeah, including some of the leadership.
Correct.
In there. So we are going to come right back with our final segment right after this.
Community to Community Development is your local grassroots organization led by women, people of color, and farm workers.
Comunidad a Comunidad es su organización local de base que es liderada por mujeres, personas de color, y campesinos.
If you care about the food that you eat and having a fair and sustainable food system, you should partner with us.
Si le importa la comida que comemos y quiere mejorar el sistema alimentario, debería juntarse con nosotros.
You can call us at 360-738-0893 or you can find us on the Facebook.
Puede comunicarse con nosotros por teléfono 360-738-0893 o encontrarnos en nuestra página de Facebook.
You are listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris, and I am here with Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. Just want to touch on this briefly, the PDC, which is our state's public disclosure committee, and they are really, we're very, very, very lucky to have them because not all states are giving candidates as much scrutiny in terms of where the money's coming from. And people hear about this PDC all the time. You know, it's one of those things, if you're a candidate or if you have an issue campaign, it's just a pain in the butt. But just a moment to say, somebody is really tracking the sources of money, and that's a state that makes us one of the better states in the union, I think. But because of that, Ferguson, our attorney general, did slap a fine on Representative Morris and former candidate Charlene Leclerc this week.
Well, filed a suit against them.
Right. And so Dave was a campaign manager on more than one occasion, and I think you have something to say about this.
Well, there were three people targeted. Representative from Edmonds, whose name escapes me, but these were all compliance charges, and there was no fraud allegations. It was you failed to report, and under Washington state law, if a citizen reports to the attorney general, hey, this happened, and the attorney general does not do something in 90 days, that citizen gets to sue on the state's behalf. So the AG has an incentive to go ahead with the process. And Morris had one violation, if I recall, and what was her name?
Charlene LeClaire.
LeClaire had a number of violations, and all of them late filings. You know, you got this, you didn't report it. You were billed for this, you didn't report it. In some of her cases, until after the actual election date. And mind-boggling to me, and the candidate is ultimately responsible for all of their filings. It is their name, their committees, their everything on the line.
But their treasure. I mean, let's be honest.
One of the violations is failing to report the fees paid to the campaign treasurer that they contracted with, which is surprising because the treasurer is the one who signs all of those.
That's an excellent point.
You know, this, but taking a step back, this is a little dance that gets done by both the Democrats and the Republicans. They are combing over everybody's filing dates and everything, and they're looking for little violations. The Republicans in Whatcom County have gotten violation upon violation over the years, and so it's payback. It's a little dance that gets done. I would say this about Representative Morris. He was a little late in reporting this particular thing. It wasn't like he was trying to conceal $5,000.
Or that he never reported it.
He was just a little late, a couple of days. He knows the drill. He knows how to do it. I think Charlene LeClaire's are maybe a little more concerning because there were more of them. But on the other hand, she's a new candidate.
First time candidate.
She's an amateur, you know, at it. I don't know who was running her campaign. I think she had, pretty good campaign coordinator, pretty good staff. You're right about the PDC. The public created the PDC by initiative. It's our doing. We want this. We want to know about money, but it's become sort of a little tool. These little, niggling complaints have sort of become a little bit of pushback, playback. So now the Republicans can claim that they're not the only ones that are violating PDC regulations.
Right. And really, but beyond wonks, who's paying all that much attention? It's anybody can access the PDC files, and it's really fun for certain citizens to get in there and investigate everything. And when I ran briefly for office, I got not an official complaint, but somebody noticed that I'd spent my own money on shoes and reported it. I don't know. Like it gets a little cockamamie, and none of it is on the Tim Iman scale of campaign violations.
Right. And I don't even think it's really what the public is interested in. What they're really interested in is they're not interested, I don't think, in Joe Smith down the block giving you some money and you having to report it instantly. They're concerned about big, gigantic floods of cash coming in from unknown sources, dark money, and really influencing the outcome of an election from the outside. So yes, there were violations. Is this really what the public wanted? No, but you know, I'm glad we have a PDC.
I'm glad that we have a PDC.
And it's tremendously annoying when it's you or it's your folks that get hit. But I'm kind of glad that there are people out there that are kind of working as the immune system. And sometimes, like say lupus, they get a little out of hand. But I think we're all better off for having them there.
Absolutely. And moving into our final topic of the day. So you'll notice that it is the 12th and 3 days away is tax day. I hope everyone has filed their taxes if they're gonna, and I haven't. And meanwhile, there is a political movement that's happening nationwide and locally to have a protest on tax day. Our very own intrepid citizen journalist, Rosa Tobin, sat down with a couple of people to talk about what's ahead.
Trump has famously said that the American people don't care about his taxes, which we know is dead wrong. There was a petition at the U.S. website that broke all records. And even after that, he said, the people don't care. So this tax march is going to show that we do care, we haven't forgotten, and we are determined to keep the pressure on. At this point, we know over 119 cities have signed up. Initially, it was 6 cities throughout the United States. It's now also several international cities. The United Kingdom, Germany, New Zealand, and Japan are all participating as well. So it's gaining momentum. It's been a little under the radar because of all the other marches, but you know, Shirley and I have decided we're reserving Saturdays to march to protest this man, which is why Shirley and I commissioned this bus. Tell us about the bus.
Well, like Ronnie said, because there was nothing planned in Bellingham, we said, well, okay, if nothing's happening in Bellingham, we will take Bellingham to Seattle. And the next thing you know, people have been so responsive. So we're excited. We're pumped. I mean, the bus is filling up.
There's a huge sense that Trump owes major money to foreign banks, foreign governments, that he is beholden to these banks, that he's not his own free agent. And the other thing is he a responsible steward of money? We need to see all this data about him.
If he had any credibility, if he had nothing to hide, he would not be pulling all of these antics to distract what's going on.
Yeah, he should be proud to show his taxes.
Exactly.
If he's this wealthy man.
That's right.
Who is such a great businessman. He should be proud to show his taxes.
And so I think long term, beyond this particular march, for the first time in the world, we have a situation where it's not just Americans, it's not just Democrats or Republicans. The whole world has concerns about America's leadership. That's a big, big deal.
So this bus is a way for Bellingham to participate in this demand that Trump release his taxes. We want to be part of the pressure, part of the demand. We want to make some noise.
And I think it'll just be a fun group on the bus. People are energetic and enthusiastic, and they're not showing anger and all of that stuff, you know. The bus departs at 8 o'clock. The march in Seattle starts down at the Federal Building at 10 o'clock. It ends up at Seattle Center, but the Black Lives Matter march is happening at the same time. But the Black Lives March extends beyond the time when ours ends.
Our idea is we're focusing on the Tax Day march, but we definitely want to lend our support to the Black Lives Matter.
So we will be able to participate in the Black Lives Matter march, and then we board the bus at 3 o'clock, and we're home before 5.
It's Cascadia News Now. You just heard Ronnie Lenore and Shirley Jacobson talking with our own citizen journalist Rosa Tobin about the tax bus. That is happening April 15th around 7:30 a.m. And you will need to get tickets to ride the bus. I hear there's only a few seats available. If you're interested, you can go to Brown Paper Tickets and look up Bellingham Tax March Bus. You can also find the event online or on Facebook very easily. And Rosa will be going down with the team and reporting, and that'll be interesting. We'll include the Black Lives Matter march in Seattle.
Well, that's good. You know, I mean, we have a president who, during the debates, said that he thought that paying taxes were for losers, and so maybe there should be some pushback on this. I mean, maybe there should be some movement up the chain of command to a guy that hasn't released his taxes and has given no assurance that he actually pays taxes.
Absolutely. And we'll hear more about that next week. We'll see if it's a national movement. Hopefully it will be. You have been listening to Cascadia News Now, and very glad to have the hosts with me that I do. Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham. I'm Stephanie Contours. A huge thank you to our engineer, Devlin Sweeney, and a huge thank you to Rosa Tobin. And, we hope you have good time at the march next week. Our technical director is Dave Willingham, and the show's produced by me, Stephanie Contours. You can find archives or the current show when it ever gets up again over at CascadiaNews.com, and we would love to hear from you. By the way, we are going to be a team. Cascadia News Now will be a trivia team at Goat Mountain Trivia, which is going to benefit KMRA, and you really should do it. It's only $5. There's going to be great prizes. That's Wednesday, April 26th at 7 p.m. And you are listening to KMRE Bellingham 102.3 FM.